Hi, this is Mike McNamara, and you're listening to All Marine Radio on your home for it, the one and only All Warrior Radio Network. All right, joining me is Alex Hollins. Alex, how are you?
What's going on, man? Happy to be here.
Well, you should be, man. Come on, I'm making you a worldwide celebrity, for God's sake.
That's what I'm saying. Every time I come here, I can feel like, you know, a little boost to my overall rating as a writer, you know?
Come on, like, well, let's be truthful. A little boost? Well, come on. What the hell
is the boost is entirely from you, because they hear me talking, it kind of takes away from the effect a bit, but, you know.
I want to ask about the president as a racist, okay? I want to get your thoughts on that. Let me give you my thoughts. Not to shape your thoughts, but so you know. There seems to me a double standard when it applies to racism, that other people can say stuff that's race-based and not be vilified for it. But the president comes close to it, and he gets in trouble. Now, I use the example of what he said relative to Charlottesville. He was factually correct about what he said. That's not what people wanted him to say, but there was alt-right people there. There was Antifa there. There were people that said, don't bleach our history. There were people that said, take those statues down. Okay? So, and I get both those legitimate sides of an intellectual debate, and I'm happy to debate that. The smaller, you know, fractional groups, right, they went there with their own agenda. But so what he said, in my opinion, he was factually correct. There were good people there on both sides. Now, he probably didn't articulate the way he should have, but that gets used that Trump is a racist, blah, blah, blah. You know, when he now takes on, it seems to me that when he takes on people of color, one of the first cards that gets played is he's a racist. And he doesn't say anything he talks about their job performance and whatnot. And so, the woman from Tennessee, Tlaib, I think, right, she calls him a motherfucker, right, the night she's elected, and she said, baby, she's talking to her son, and I think the quote goes like this, baby, we're going to Washington, D.C., and take that motherfucker down. Now, he blasts her, and then he gets called a racist. You know, Lilian Omar, she talks about that somebody did something on September 11th. And even when the House went to censure her, they completely watered it down. They made it a very generic statement. And she was made almost to look like the victim in all of that. You know, AOC goes down the border and talks about concentration camps, right? And she's not held to, you know, a standard about what she says. But it seemed to me the president gets held to a different standard. Not one thing he said about Elijah Cummings was racist. It was that Baltimore is a shithole. And you could defend that statement in court, right? Because truth is defense and libel, just so everybody knows. So I'm curious. And you study the media too. Because there is no hotter way to make your clickbait clicks go up than to put out inflammatory stories, and the president's the number one gift giver to media on the planet. So, with all that being said, give me your take on that coverage and what you think.
Well, I think you nailed it completely, but the only mistake in the way that you were breaking it down is that you were looking for some kind of reason to be the fuel behind it. And that's the problem. What the real issue here is, there's a couple of disparate elements that come together in this Trump's a racist camp, right? The first one, and I do think it is fair to say that he has certainly said insensitive things in the past, right?
No doubt.
And as a result of that, they've kind of primed the situation to call him a racist, right? So I'm not ready to argue that Trump, you know, as a president or as a guy, harbors absolutely no racist ideas. He very well might, for all I know. But that's kind of not the point here. The point here is that calling someone a racist is an extremely effective way to discredit them in today's world, right?
Right.
You know, that's the number one fear that most white guys have in the media, is that they could, for some reason, be construed as either a racist or a misogynist, because in our culture right now, those are, you know, and reasonably so, but those are big targets, right? You know, we're tearing down the patriarch in a lot of ways with things like the Me Too movement and internet outrage as a whole. And the idea that, you know, what started, I think the Me Too movement, as an example, started as something that probably had good intentions, but it just grew into something uncontrollable. Race is a very similar thing. There are real racial divides in our country that actually need addressing. Those kind of fall by the wayside in favor of using race as a political weapon, right?
Right.
So Donald Trump is a good example of where both gender and race are both used more often as a political weapon than as an actual subject at hand that we need to try to improve the discourse in our nation. When people call Donald Trump a racist, they're not saying things need to get better, we need to improve. They're saying, I hate Donald Trump, you know? Now, I'm on record many a time on this show saying I'm not a big fan of Donald Trump. One of the reasons is because he does a really bad job of selling what it is that he's saying. You know, what you were saying about Antifa and, you know, these white supremacists squaring off, I would argue that that was two groups of assholes fighting in a park.
Right, no, and you would be factually correct. And they scheduled the fight, and they,
absolutely.
They were looking, you know, to have what happened. That's what they wanted to create.
And again, I really do want to emphasize this one more time, that if I'm in a park with my child and there's a group of white supremacists that are peacefully demonstrating on the far end of the park, and or a group of communists, of socialists, peacefully demonstrating on one end of the park, and you show up dressed in your closest approximation of medieval battle armor and pick a fight in that park, you're a bad guy. Anybody who uses violence to convey their political beliefs is a bad guy, especially here within the borders of the United States. We do not use violence as a part of our political system, as a part of our political discourse. So even if you're punching a Nazi, you're a bad guy. I really want to make sure that I impart that here. That Nazi may be an asshole, but he's not a Nazi like he fought for Adolf Hitler in World War II. He's a Nazi like he's an asshole who knows that using this title is going to evoke an emotional response from you, and that's what he wants, right? So if you go and start punching that guy in the face, you're giving him what he wants. You're ruining the park for everybody. You're an asshole, too. You're a bunch of assholes. So to get back
to Trump, and to me the thing is you give them what they want. And to me, do you remember, it was probably months after the thing happened in Charlottesville, and there was going to be some kind of like alt-right event in Boston. And so, and like, I don't know, like tens of thousands of people turned out to protest against it. And, right, the nine people that were going to show up for the rally never showed up, right? The rally didn't take place. And so you're looking at it going, look, I don't know what's a good ratio relative to leveraging something, but you're giving these idiots exactly what they want. You're giving them a national forum for their hate. And it's like, so you look at it like, okay, so who does this serve?
You're absolutely right. Who does it serve? And I asked the same question in the opposite direction with Antifa. It's my personal belief here, you know, and I know a couple of guys who have done embedded work with Antifa and stuff like that. And I really do think that Antifa formally is like 300 idiots.
Right.
You know, I'm sure that over the span of the 300 plus million Americans, there is a network of thousands that are loosely affiliated or that would voice support on Facebook or things like that. But when it comes to what Antifa really is, like what this group that we devote thousands of words to in USA Today and all this stuff, it's like 300 assholes, you know, in a nation of 320 million. So if you were to take Antifa...
Yeah, like, hello, leverage. Like,
yeah,
that's
exactly,
not bad.
Exactly, you know. But, you know, this all does speak directly to what we're talking about with Donald Trump. Which
but wait, can I tell you one other thing? Can I tell you one more thing? And is that this? I talk, and you've heard me say this. If you watch the nightly news, that's not our country. That is a select group of idiots, right, that are doing stupid things that is designed to get you to watch and to click so that they can make money off that. Whenever shit happens, whether your house is set on fire in in the woods of Georgia, or when you're affected by a flood, you know, people just come and they help. And that's what Americans do. And that's our country. And so, to me, like your point, it's 300 people. It's a bunch of, I won't even say they're dropped on their head after they've been born, right? And, you know, they've grown up with this warped, demented view of people, and this is the way they get attention.
But what do we tend to do, you know? And we do the same thing here when it comes to, you know, the white supremacists that have experienced a cultural resurgence, because, again, we're leveraging the media on their behalf. But what do? We associate the whole left with Antifa, and we associate the whole right with these white supremacists. When, again, like you're saying, we're talking about 300 people. You know what
right,
I mean?
And that's what's, I mean, you're watching it be leveraged, and it's stunning. And then you hear.
And so what we're creating is straw man arguments. You know, we're creating, so here from my position, I tend to be a more conservative guy. So from my position, it's easy for me to argue against the straw man Antifa leftist that I can envision in my head. It's a lot harder to argue with like a one well-reasoned person that has good intentions and just a slightly different perspective than my own, right?
Right.
And you see that the same way, you know, coming from left to right, you know, it's a lot easier to assume that every person who voted for Donald Trump, or even if you didn't vote for Donald Trump, but you agree with or defend some of his positions, every person who does that, it's much easier to make them that straw man white supremacist. Just like Donald Trump, it's much easier to make him that straw man white supremacist than it is to accept the idea that there might be a complex series of motivations at play here, like there is for literally every human on the planet, right? Donald Trump has got a lot of different things going on at once because he's the president, right? So there's a lot of different angles that either he or the people who work for him, I sincerely hope and I genuinely believe, are taking into account. So, Donald Trump might do a real crappy job of conveying his messages, right? Which is the one thing I thought we were signing up for.
Well, let me ask you this.
A good salesman.
Is it? Or does he, or would you subscribe to the theory that, no, he knows exactly what he's doing. And he,
I think sometimes he does.
He
I think
specifically
it's
crafts it.
I think sometimes it's not.
Yeah, specifically crafts it to take him to the edge, and then he walks it back because he's...
Well, that's his approach. I mean, we see him do it with foreign leaders all the time, too. You know, he talks a real hard game until he meets you,
right?
And then you're the best friends in the world, right? It's the approach that he's used in business his whole life, and it's the approach he uses in politics. The thing about Donald Trump is that he doesn't do a good job of insulating himself against these accusations. And that is, in my opinion, that's one of the shortfalls of his camp. But from the opposing point of view, you don't have to argue with the merit of anything that Donald Trump says if you just discount it as racist. And that's the point here.
Right.
You know, and to be honest with you, it was the same point that he had when he was going after, you know, these four congresswomen that are extremely liberal, you know, saying that they hate America last week. I think that you could make a reasonable argument that they haven't demonstrated a real love for America, but you could also argue that that's the reason why you get into politics is because you're trying to shape the nation into something you do love. That's a good thing to do. I may not agree with their politics. I certainly don't agree with their politics.
Right.
Donald Trump was making the same effect. He was using the same tactic, which is, we don't need to discuss the merits of anything that AOC says. We don't need to discuss the merits of anything that any of these women say because they hate America. It's as simple as that. And the response is, we don't have to discuss the merit of anything Donald Trump says because he's a white supremacist. Ad hominem form of attack is a classic tactic to avoid talking about what it is that we're supposed to be talking about. You know, in my opinion, it's all bullshit. And I think most of the people who use it know that it's bullshit. It's easier to argue with that than it is to argue the points of the matter.
So to me, it was pretty clear what Trump was trying to do. And that was staple them, right, to Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi's forehead as...
Oh, not just to them, but he also
everybody,
wants to staple
right?
the idea of this far, like, not moderate left, but far left.
This
and socialist group. This is who he's running for president against. It won't be one of these four women. But these four women are so popular that no matter what, whoever the Democratic candidate in the 2020 election is, they are going to have to take a public position on these four women.
Okay, so that's his attempt to staple them as the leadership of the Democratic Party. And with
if
the
not the leadership,
right?
At the very least as a representative of
right.
the Democratic Party.
So, and then the other side is, the racist thing is, no matter what he says, we'll call him a racist, and we'll paint him as a racist, and he'll cooperate
and
with
his.
Some
people, they believe it. You know, yeah, some people believe that Donald Trump's sole motivation throughout his presidency is race. I think that that's a ludicrous. Even if Donald Trump is a racist, there's a lot of other things at play here other than race in the decisions that he's making as president. And the same way that I always argue that people tend not to vote based on race. I know that in the media we love to pretend
right.
that people vote based on race, but more often than not, individual voters are voting based on who they think will benefit them. It's a self-serving exercise, right? If you live in rural America and one of the candidates is saying that he wants to get stimulus to rural America and the other candidate couldn't give a shit, you're going to vote for the candidate that wants to get stimulus to rural America. If you live in urban America and one of the candidates is talking about bringing back clean coal and the other one is talking about programs that will benefit you in the city, you're going to vote for that candidate that benefits the city. More often than not, I think most people aren't going, I'm going to vote for Donald Trump because I hate black guys. Or I'm going to vote for Hillary Clinton because I love black guys. Neither of those statements holds true. Voting for Donald Trump doesn't help you hate black guys, and voting for Hillary Clinton doesn't help you love them. Because in any voting situation, what you're trying to do is make your life better, make the lives of people you care about better. You're not worried about making some theoretical other's life worse. That's a ludicrous proposition, and the idea that Americans are voting based on it is insulting.
Let me read you an email. Mac, sometimes I think the president is over the top, and I think most conservatives say that, but we have no other choice.
That's where you're wrong. I don't buy that shit for a heartbeat.
Hold on. He's the only guy right now. Do you think he's going to have a legitimate challenger in the primary? I don't. So, really, as an elect...
I absolutely loathe this idea that the bad guy on my team is better than the good guy on anyone else's.
Well, that's not... Let me finish the email. My question for you and Alex is this. As you say, there's a third of the country that votes Republican, a third that votes Democrat, then a third that's in the middle, and they have elected different people as we've gone through successive election cycles, all the way from George Bush the Elder on one end to Barack Obama on the other. So they go back and forth. Do you think these are simply today's political movements?
Yes.
By operators in order to influence that middle third of voters, and that's what this is only about.
I think to a certain degree you're 100% right, but I want to get back to this idea that Donald Trump's our only choice. We create this reality ourselves. You know,
wow.
This is the same problem with people who like to vilify the media. And I know I am a guy representing the media.
Yeah,
thing.
You are the media. We're vilifying you.
You know, when you vilify that, when you say the media is out there to get us, the media is the enemy of the people, or the media is feeding us fake news, what you're really saying is the outlets that I choose to click on. The places that I go looking for media is tricking me. And instead of me looking for other places to seek media, instead of me looking for other voices, I would rather just be mad. You know, and we do the same thing with politics. We go, oh, well, Donald Trump's, you know, I don't really like Donald Trump. Well, I think a lot of conservatives would say that they don't like Donald Trump. But what's the alternative? You know, it's either Trump or a socialist. And no, man, we create this reality with voter turnout and starting with local elections. You know, Donald Trump has the authority that he has in large part because he has the support of his party, right? Because you're the president that puts you at really the head of the party, right? The problem is that even a lot of the people in the party sometimes have problems with Donald Trump, but he has so much popular support in places like social media that you cannot stand up to Donald Trump as a Republican. As a result, what we get is we get a party that's based right now on Donald Trump's policies rather than on the party's policies. You know, if you individually, if all of us individually stand up and say, oh, this isn't what we elected this guy for. You know, I honestly, I didn't have a big problem with the bump stock ban. but I know a lot of guys who voted for Donald Trump because he was a supporter of the Second Amendment. Donald Trump has passed more legislation limiting firearms than Barack Obama did. You know, so I know a lot of conservatives who are like, well, this isn't what we elected this guy for, but God forbid you say something like that on Facebook, you'll get inundated by your friends calling you a socialist, you know, telling you to vote for AOC. That's the problem. This or that mentality that we maintain and enforce in our social groups is a big problem.
Well, let me just tell you, I think I understand what you're saying intellectually, but I think practically, when you look at how money flows to political candidates, to me, it's the whole little engine that could thing. The little engine can't, because the little engine doesn't have enough money.
The little engine that could, but literally every company at one point, unless you were started by an existing conglomerate, but even those conglomerates started somewhere. Everything started somewhere. You and I have had this debate a million times before, but this idea of the little engine that could, you think that it'll never work. It's literally the only thing that ever works. You know, we can't wait for CNN to fix this problem for us. And, like, I know that we all want either the law or the conglomerates to change the way things work so that we'll like it better. But the fact of the matter is that that's our problem. Our problem is that when a shooting happens, like this terrible shooting in California that just occurred,
right,
the first thing everybody wants to talk about is national gun laws.
Right.
You know, the first thing that we want to do is we want people who live 3,000 miles and 250 million people away from that shooting to have their lives directly affected by what happened in California this weekend, right? That's not the right solution. The right solution to these problems is pragmatic local solutions, right? If you really want there to be a limit on the firearms that are available in your community, the solution is to try to get legislation passed in your community. Not nationwide, but we only want nationwide solutions, right? And when we can't get them legally, then we look to things like Twitter and Facebook, and we demand that they fix the world for us instead. Because, again, Facebook is so big that it's an authority figure in our eyes now. So instead, again, of me changing my practices, instead of changing how I hate share stuff, instead of changing how I comment on things, I want Facebook to fix it. I want Twitter to fix it. If I can't get Congress to do it, then I want Facebook to do it. And if I can't get Facebook to do it, it just can't happen. And that's not true, man. We invented all this bullshit. We need to take responsibility for our actions. If enough people take responsibility for their own actions, there will be a shift in our culture. We can't wait for CNN to shift the culture for us.
So they're making a ton of money. Do you read The Little Engine That Could to your daughter every night?
I don't, but you know what? Maybe I should. Maybe I should.
Because if
you want to live in the fantasy where Congress and corporations are going to fix the country for us, you are out of your goddamn mind. I'm not saying this to you directly, Mac. I'm saying this to everybody in general.
If you think that a bunch of self-interested old people in
Congress and a bunch of self-interested rich people running a corporation are going to make anything better, you're out of your mind.
I agree with you. I agree with that. But and here I have this to say about that. It's worse than the little engine that could, because the whole game is rigged against
you. The system is fixed against you.
It is stacked financially, right? It is stacked in our legal proceedings. You know, when the Supreme Court ruled that corporations are on an equal footing with people relative to campaign contributions, how do I compete with, how do we as individuals compete pharmaceutical industry?
That's the really important question, right? Because I think that what you're raising a really important point here, which is that the battle we're talking about is a difficult one. It's an incredibly difficult one. Maybe even it might even seem insurmountable. That doesn't mean it's less important, right?
No.
The American Revolution was a little engine that could. The American Revolution was a fight we had no right to win, right? But we did it because it was important. We were fighting for the fabric of our nation.
If you start playing background music, I'm gonna hang up on you. No, I agree with you.
We are still literally fighting for the fabric of our nation.
I agree with you, but it's so disillusioning because this whole thing. So to me, you know, the McNamara's solution, federalize elections, right? You compete to get into the election. Everybody gets the same amount of money. We put, you know,
That may feasibly be an answer, but even
not,
that raises a lot of real
scary flags. It's not an answer. But other than that, why do you have the right to buy an election? Why do you have...
I agree, man. And I think that you're right about federalizing elections, or at least, election campaign reform, I think is integral, right? We got to do it. We have to do it. You're totally right. But, you know, we always have those concerns when you come to federalizing elections. I don't know that that would be that much different than having the heads of two parties making the decisions about who gets seen and who gets paid and who actually gets campaign financing. You know,
the parties are the problem.
Systems.
We eliminate the parties because, and here's why.
This is the thing. You're not going to be able, you're not, what you might do is you can eliminate the names, but you're not going to eliminate the biases.
Trust me. Okay. So once we take the label Democrat and Republican off the board, right, and you're just going to run as Alex Hollings, concerned citizen. Okay, because what happens is when you look at the bell curve in Congress, 80% of the people are under the bell curve. There's 10% on each fringe, okay? But once you put that stripe down the middle, nobody has a majority of votes to get anything done, so you have to embrace the fringe to get the shit done. Once we ban parties, all of a sudden the 80% that's kind of sort of near the same place says, okay, well, if we tweak it like this or tweak it like this, it's called compromise. We can't do it anymore.
There are some big problems with banning the party system with the way our voting works.
Yeah, I know. Don't bother me with reality. Okay, I'm trying to get you to a better place, goddammit.
Fair enough.
Don't bother me.
But I do think, though, that what you're talking about and is way closer to what we need. You know, George Washington didn't affiliate himself with either party.
And he warned. Right? He warned about it, right?
And he warned about it. And I feel this way personally. This is the reason why getting at what I was saying earlier about I don't believe in this taking the bad guy on my team over the good guy on anyone else's. I don't buy this bullshit. Admittedly, I have not voted for a Democrat in a presidential election at any point in my adult life.
But you're not ruling that out.
But I won't rule it out. No, I do this hypothetical game in my head every so often where I go, okay, what Democratic candidate could run? What would a Democratic candidate have to offer me to get my vote, right? And it's a pretty long list, you know? To be honest with you, that long list is the same long list that I ask for out of a Republican candidate, you know? But it's more often met by Republican candidates just because my own beliefs, my own perspective tends to skew more conservative, right?
All right.
But the idea that I would, I remember as a kid, you know, my dad said things like, you know, when in doubt, vote Republican. And I think that's how a lot of people do tend to vote, is I'll readily admit this. Mac, I think that you're a confident enough guy, you'll probably admit it too. You've probably gone and voted in local elections at some point I don't even mean in your life, but like in the last decade, where you've probably cast a vote or two for a guy where you were like, oh shit, I don't know anything about this guy. Right?
Yeah.
It happens to all of us. Because when you go to vote, you go to vote and there's 16 people, or, you know, there's 16 separate elections on the ticket. You did your best to do the research ahead of time. You've been reading about this coming up because you and I are both more well-informed, I would argue, than your average voter. And I don't mean because they're irresponsible Americans, but because our profession helps us be informed.
No, right? And truth be told, we're smarter.
You know, better looking for sure. And when I get in there, and I'm a guy who writes about politics regularly, and I go, oh shit, man, I don't know who this guy is. So what do I have to do? I have to make a decision.
Well, come on, who reads about the assistance insurance commissioner anyway?
I try to only because I constantly preach about the importance of local elections, right? So I try my best to be as privy as I can, right? But privy doesn't mean you know everything, right? So if I get in there and I go, all right, I came here to vote for, like, you know, three offices and I've got to choose 12, right?
Right.
You do your best and you tend to vote along party lines. It's how a lot of us do it, you know?
No doubt.
The problem is, as much like our tax system, is we have made our political system so complicated that you need a guide to understand who and what and where and how to vote. And on top of that, you tend not to give a shit about most of the things because it's very difficult for you to comprehend any way where the county coroner, number one, is an elected position, and number two, what does that matter to me? You know? That's why a lot of these positions tend to run uncontested, because people don't give a shit, you know. But it's really hard for us to complain about the state of national politics when we're not playing an active role in our local ones, because local politics combine and coalesce into our national politics, you know. But to get back to our original question about whether or not Trump's a racist, for all I know, probably, but I don't think it would matter. You know, I think that Donald Trump may well harbor some of the classic 74-year-old man ideas of race and gender, that, you know, when your grandfather says it, you roll your eyes, but when the president says it, you're like, oh, shit, you can't say that on TV, man.
Yeah.
But I think most Americans know that that's not really the way that we tend to do business. That's what a 74-year-old guy says. That said, I think that Donald Trump is called a racist far more often than he ever says or even asserts anything that could be attributed to racism, because it's a real easy way to discredit anything he said.
Right.
We're talking about orbital defense, and for some reason race comes up. It's obviously got nothing to do with the topic at hand, right?
All right. So it's just essentially they're trying to do with Trump. And again, Trump, though, again, I would say it, massage, no, it is what xenophobic, in my opinion. What he said, if you were going to categorize what he said about those women, it would be xenophobic. It wouldn't
yeah,
be. It
yeah,
wouldn't,
I think that's probably fair. And I
it wouldn't be. It wouldn't be racist. And I don't. And I said at the time, you know, that reminds me of what people said during the Vietnam War when I was a kid. America, love it or leave it. Like, yeah, there might be a little bit more gray in there that you would care to admit to, but, you know, and we should probably discuss that. But that should not be the, yeah, America, love it or leave it. There's a lot of different ways to love your country.
Well, yeah, especially because, like, I firmly believe that what's great about America is that we are constantly trying to improve.
Right.
You know, this American experiment in democracy, like, that's not just a turn of phrase. It is because when we started, we had no idea what the hell we were doing.
And nobody,
to this day,
and nobody
we have
had
no
ever,
idea what the hell we're doing.
And nobody had ever tried this shit before. You know, let me tell you, what arouses my ire is when I see Miss AOC go down to the border, and she comes out, right, full of venom and just blasting everybody. But where is the legislation to correct these things? These things exist because of the level of funding and what the laws Congress has passed. So the Democrats have largely ignored that. So it's just a fucking game you're playing.
No, you're totally right.
And
although
so that,
I do, in the interest of being fair here, I think it's important that we note that this is the exact same tactic we see Donald Trump using all the time.
Yeah, I agree.
You know?
It's a game.
It's a game. You know, AOC, in my opinion, is literally just the Democrat equivalent of Donald Trump. You know,
right.
Donald Trump, the best way to really inspire the far-right conservative base is for a self-made-ish, a successful businessman. You know what I mean? That's the best way. The best way to inspire the really far-left base is to have, you know, a young woman, an empowered woman, especially a minority woman, you know, speaking to power. You know, these are, and I'm not, in either case, I'm not saying this as an insult to either party. What I'm saying is, like, if you were making a movie that you were trying to engage a very specific demographic, you would make a movie to engage the left's demo that would have a protagonist that would look just like AOC, right?
Okay.
She'd be a young, strong, minority immigrant woman who came from, you know, a difficult background and worked her way up. If you were making a movie that you wanted to really sell to a conservative demographic, your protagonist would be Clint Eastwood or Donald Trump. It'd be a rich old white guy, right? This is just marketing 101. AOC and Donald Trump use very similar tactics.
You know, but the thing that pisses me off is there's real people that have real problems out there, and we play this game of chicken for the presidency. And
you're exactly right.
And it sucks.
And
the nation, right? And the nation has important work in front of it, and we can't. And it can't do. It can't do any of it. Oh shit! The hammer just got dropped. All right, new subject.
All right.
You have to do that with Hollings, okay?
I won't stop.
Relentless. Two more subjects. All right, that we have to cover. The total now is up to 21 Marines that have been arrested in a
in an
immigration smuggling. None of those 21 joined the Marine Corps to smuggle immigrants into our country. What's going on? Does the Marine Corps have? I just had General Mattis on last
Which,
week.
Which, by the way, man, awesome. I shared it all across social media just because I was like, normally I only share things about me because I'm, self-centered. But this is awesome. Like, you guys need to read
it. Right? I mean, how cool is that? But
amazing.
So
I have to say, if anything, it's a huge honor to me that I was on the same show a day prior to General James Madison.
Well, you know, and that sequencing.
I thank you for giving me that.
That sequencing wasn't by accident either, okay? It was designed to build audience, so that's the way we did that thing. The ramping up into General Mattis, okay? You know, we got to bring the next biggest star that I have on the program right before the biggest.
Yeah, exactly.
So, what's going on in the Marine Corps?
You're not gonna like my answer to this, man.
Well, I don't care. Go ahead, let it rip.
All right. So I think that we're talking about the same thing as Antifa here. I don't think that I'm ready to say what's going on in the Marine Corps quite yet. This sounds to me more like a group of assholes. I think it's important that we remember that Marines are people first and foremost, right? And so these Marines all found themselves in a situation where they were stationed right near the Mexican border, right? Right now, it's obviously a very heated political minefield of a situation, but I distinctly remember my days on active duty. I had a corporal that worked in the S2, that I worked hand in hand with a lot, who was, he was a socialist, and he was happy to tell you that he was a socialist. He believed in the Marine Corps. He was a damn good Marine, to be honest with you. He and I fought constantly about politics because we just couldn't find any political common ground to see the world from. But professionally, I never had trouble with this guy at all. He was a great analyst. But, you know, Marines come from all political backgrounds and affiliations, just yeah. like any group of people do, right?
Yeah.
I'd be willing to bet that some of these Marines had connections on the other side of the border, probably because they had family
right.
on the other side of the border, which makes it all that much more complicated. You know, it's easy for us, you know, border security is obviously essential for any nation. But I think it is easier for me to talk about it than my best buddy who immigrated from the Dominican Republic. He's actually, to be honest with you, he's more strict about immigration than I am because it was difficult for him to do properly.
Right.
And so as a result, he has a lot of respect for the process.
And not a whole lot of tolerance for people.
And not a whole lot of tolerance for people who aren't willing to go through the process. He served his country.
But I don't want to talk about immigration. So you just think this is 21 assholes in 1-5 who decided that
I think
you don't
what it really was, I think
a larger,
it was probably five real big assholes that had a network and connection and needed help. And I think that they roped in some guys that were maybe assholes to a lesser extent, and when you get out to the furthest, you know, because there were 16 originally arrested, and there's been more questions answered. There's a couple of ringleaders involved here.
Right.
Right.
Two originally a few weeks ago, 16 last week, and
in formation, which I love.
I would love. I'd have paid to watch that with the following Marines, and then cuff them and lead them out and watch everybody go.
Shame
with
these
them.
Dudes with red promotion warrants in your hands, like
right.
as the oh, I love it. Oh
right.
man,
the,
it gets the platoon sergeant and me just like I'm salivating. I just love this idea. I want to take those 16 guys and start another formation off to the side and just tear them apart. But I think that until we see anything, I mean, obviously there's a leadership failure at play here, but there's a, you know, we're talking about E4s and below in garrison. We're talking about the Lance Corporal Underground in a very legitimate way here, you know?
Right.
I think that what we're seeing here is a local leadership failure, but there's a good chance that what we're seeing here is a group of Marines that that were not living, you know, the code that Marines live by, right? But I'm not sure that I'm ready to call it systemic Marine Corps wide or anything crazy like that.
All right, I talk about this shit all the time. All right, so let me ask you a question. Would it surprise you to know that companies don't have formations so much anymore?
That it would hurt me. It hurts my heart.
That,
but I guess it wouldn't surprise me. Because even in my time, you know, and I got out in 2012.
Okay.
You know, so not all that long ago, but long enough ago that Marines don't talk to me in public anymore,
right?
Right? And we were already moving away from company level formations at regular intervals and doing a lot of section formations and stuff like that. We did do some company level formations every so often, but usually just for PT, You know, so we probably only did two or three company formations a month, I would say, when I was on. And then, although it's important to note, I spent the last 4 years that I was on active duty training reservists, where there were only 35 active duty Marines in the friggin' state. So, yeah. You know, my perspective is skewed pretty dramatically.
Okay, so here's what I would postulate to you. That the reason when the company gunny is not doesn't see you but once or twice a week, maybe.
That's bad. Yeah, I would agree that's bad.
You have novices supervising novices. Now, one of my sons was just in a West Coast battalion. And so when this came up, I asked him, I said, did you guys have company formations? He said, we had two a week, one on Monday and one on Friday. And so the rest of the week you have hopefully a staff sergeant, but maybe not. So maybe a sergeant, and if he's not around, a corporal as the person. So,
it's important to note because your audience is pretty Marine based. In any other branch, that's unheard of. You know, right. There's a reason why E4s in the Army are not NCOs. I mean, unless you go to corporal's course and pass some tests. The idea of having a lance corporal or a corporal leading Marines is unheard of across the other branches. You know, when we say small unit leadership in the Marine Corps, we mean it.
But you know, I would tell you this. They're essentially novices. They're first-term people in the Marine Corps, and we give them responsibility. But if they're not supervised, right, if they don't have to answer to the gunny the way we've done it for decades, maybe centuries.
You know, still 19.
Right. And so to me, you have novices supervising novices with all the respect that novices give each other, you know, even though you may be the senior lance. Right, you're still a novice, and it's that hammer of the gunny that looks and says, "Yo, numbnuts," and then right, Hollings looks, me, yeah, you, come here, come hither, right? Without that, to me, I don't know how the Marine Corps. If that's how the Marine Corps functions today,
and you're nailing an important part of the unit dynamic,
yeah.
Right? We're like, here's a great example. On I&I duty, I ran into this a lot, where everybody in the shop's the same rank. You know? We're all sergeants in here. We got six sergeants in the office.
Right.
And in some units, that very quickly becomes everybody eats each other, you know? I'm an outspoken guy. I'm a pretty big guy physically, and I tend to like to take charge. So I found myself in a leadership position among my group, my sergeant, my peer group, but only because they allowed it. Right?
Right.
If there's another guy like me, you can't have two of me in a room, right? We're going to fight.
Right?
And that happens a lot in the Marine Corps. There's always this competition for who it is that's in that leadership role. And if you're in a section that's got very few people who like to lead, very few natural leaders, or if you're in a shop that's got a ton of very aggressive leaders, you need the fear of daddy to make things work.
Hello.
You know?
Hello.
When I first checked into my shop, we had, you know, we always had a chief warrant officer and a staff NCO across the hall, right? So I'm in charge of this office, sure, but if we raise a ruckus or if something comes down from the
right.
CO, there's going to be a master guns in here to tear my head off. And if it's not my head being torn off, it's going to be one of our heads, and one of our heads is as good as all of our heads. You need that fear of daddy, you know? And
I don't know how it works if you don't have that. So, and again, same thing with shit like field day. And so we're not, well, it's more of a general cleanup. So to me, you know, the state, and here's the, to me the most significant thing, is the senior enlisted leadership of a country, of a company, right? I mean, those guys have been around. There's normally a reason that they're there. And we need and junior Marines need that. They need that wire brush. And let me tell you, of all the billets in the Marine Corps that I never got a chance to hold, there's two that I lament. One is being a lance corporal, and maybe in front of that.
Having been a lance corporal, I don't think.
Number two.
I think it's hilarious. You would miss it.
Yes. And number two is being
If you want, you could definitely come clean my house.
being a company gunny. Company gunny, it's like the best. You're supposed to wire burst people. You're supposed to have a ton of personality. And you just run around, like, ruining shit all day.
You've got the right personality to be a company gunny. I think that's because company gunny is... I was a sergeant when I was medically retired, when they threw me out for being a problem, for being broken all the time. But, I was at that point where I was looking toward being a staff NCO. And to be honest with you, I didn't have a lot of interest in being a staff NCO. But company gunny was one of the few jobs I felt like, or and first sergeant as well, just because I'm a people person, and there are a few things I like doing more than yelling at people, especially. It just seemed like an awesome way to get to do that with some humor in my life. You can't tell me company gunnies don't go in their office and laugh.
Look, it's like Def Jam comedy hour listening to them.
Every time your Marines do something stupid in the barracks and you get torn apart by a lieutenant colonel, you're not happy. But
exactly. No, I mean, and they get presented with the stupidest shit in the world, right?
Oh, man, being a company gunny's got to be like being a babysitter. It's got to be the most high-stress babysitting gig in the world. But, I mean, just like being a drill instructor, I really think that it's got to come with a lot of humor.
It doesn't. But let me tell you this. To me... if that's where the Marine Corps is at, that we're not having company formations, and my companies were, 07 or 730, whatever the hell we did, and then 1300, and then 1700 to Sound Liberty Call. Everybody was there, and it's important. That's how people got their uniforms looked at. That's how people got their haircuts looked at. And then somebody doesn't show up. That's how we know something's wrong. And so if you can imagine, Alex, now that goes down to the platoon level. And guys don't show up for formation, but they text.
I can give you a very real example of why that's such a bad thing in a legitimate way. The way that I found out one of my Marines died once was because he didn't show up to formation. These formations aren't just a formality. We had a Friday evening formation and a Monday morning formation. When he didn't show up to Monday morning formation, I went looking for him, This when we talk about accountability, we're not just talking about making sure you get your hair cut, but that is important. I'm a stickler. I am maybe all Marines are sticklers when it comes to uniform regulations and haircuts, but maybe I'm even more because I think that it's what sets us apart from these other branches that don't seem to devote much energy or time to worrying about the simple things. Because I ascribe to the idea that if you can't do the simple, how could I ask you to do the complex?
Well, and you won't. You won't.
And you won't do it.
That's a dangerous path. And so this is kind of an epiphany to me within the last 2 weeks that we don't hold company formation. And honestly, I was stunned.
And I think that's a bad thing, man. That's bad for unit cohesion.
I was stunned when my number two son said, yeah, we had two a week normally to give out awards. And like, so on a daily basis, your company gunny wasn't looking at your Marines and your platoon. He said no.
I mean, I can hear the arguments from the other side, though. I can hear them.
I can't.
I could definitely argue that gathering an entire company's worth of Marines three times a day and then dispersing them is going to eat up a lot of potential training time. I get it. I do. Especially if you're located in different places of the base, right? If your shops are in
That's different, right? That's different. And I understand what you're saying there. But what I'm talking about are infantry battalions where our barracks are over there, the grinders right there, and the company office is right there.
If you're all co-located, there's zero explanation for not having. I mean, we had company formations three times a day at one point out in 29 Palms as a punishment, but we never did full company formations. Although, when I say full company formations,
but you're talking about H&S Corps.
The difference between a full company and not a full company was just whether or not the leadership showed up.
And the difference between the disparate elements of H&S company and a rifle company
and a Victor unit is different.
That is punishment because they're scattered all over the base.
Exactly. Because we had some guys driving a half an hour in and then a half an hour back out for the formation. And it was like, well, this is what happens when one of us doesn't do whatever dumb thing it is.
All right, now final element of the discussion today. SEALs are in the news again.
Surprise!
Give me your take.
Is anyone surprised?
Well, if they were, I mean, they should be dissuaded.
I'll tell you who's acting surprised. The media is pretending to be surprised. I got to tell you, so Jack Murphy just recently left NewsRep as the editor-in-chief after years and years. He helped found the site in 2012. Jack Murphy is the go-to guy when it comes to this stuff because, man, for the last 4 years that I've worked with Jack, Jack has been reporting largely on Navy SEALs, but across the special operations community. Jack's been reporting on this stuff, literally been reporting on Navy SEALs raping. One story that he was pursuing for a long time was about a group of Navy SEALs that had all covered for one another when they had beaten the hell out of and raped one of the SEALs' wives. You know, I'm not saying that all Navy SEALs are bad guys. The problem is that within the community, there's long been this protect our own culture, which I think is integral to what you do in special operations, right?
Well, and it all got reinforced out of the Gallagher trial, right?
Absolutely.
Don't break ranks, because we'll cover down and we'll protect each other, and we'll even have people that get immunity that change their stories to protect us.
To protect one another.
But do not side against us. It's like the mafia, right?
It absolutely is. You know, I've spoke to spouses in the special operations community who have voiced really big concerns, and I said, well, I'll be honest with you, I could probably make a bigger story out of your spouse saying some of these things to me. The reason why that'd be a bigger story is just because if you can put, you know, Navy SEAL in a headline, more people will click on it.
Right.
But I often hear from the spouses, well, my husband isn't going to talk about this
right.
because he's afraid of retaliation from within the unit.
Right.
And I don't necessarily mean, although it is feasible that retaliation could be physical abuse, but it could be as simple as being ostracized.
Simple?
It's exactly. That's not a small thing. That could get you killed.
Right. Worse than that, I mean, if my identity is with that trident, right? Now what am I? A man without a country anymore?
Man.
I'm nobody.
And you're in this community. You're in this community that you worked so hard. You had to accomplish something incredible just to earn a chair at this table. It's really difficult to turn on the guys at the other seats, right?
Oh, my God.
But you know what? So what we've been saying
every fiber in your body is screaming, we don't do that. We don't do that. So imagine, for instance, in the Gallagher trial, what had to happen. I mean, the quotes from the guys who went forward were, I shot more ammunition warning civilians so he wouldn't kill them, right, than I did at actual bad guys during that deployment. And you heard these stories, and you're like, holy shit, man. That stuff's crazy.
You know, and now just imagine being the junior SEAL, the brand new SEAL in this platoon, right? Where you're looking at not just like a leader within your unit, but you're looking at a proven warfighter that other people recognize and respect as a badass, right? It's a very difficult position to put a young, brand new SEAL in, to be the guy who's going to blow the whistle on. I mean, someone that you hold in such a high regard.
Well,
right?
You've come out of the schoolhouse, and you've been told, "Hey, look, you're gonna be put in situations." And let me tell you what, you're owed to the nation, right? And you can hear them saying this in school. You're owed to the nation, right? Is something that you have to take seriously now because the SEALs have, you know, they're sensitive to this stuff, right? And then now I go to an operating unit. And I get told, yeah, look, all that's fine, okay? But this is the real world, and this is how it works. Your oath to the nation is subordinate to your oath to our oaths to each other.
You know, and I think that it is important to note that they're in a position that quickly gets desensitized to these types of things. And by that, what I mean is, as a Navy SEAL, particularly if you're in SEAL Team 6 or Delta, you know, which is kind of an Army equivalent in terms of tiers,
right.
But when you're operating at that level, you are literally the manifestation of America's foreign policy, right? You are enacting America's foreign policy at the point of engagement. But the other thing that you are is almost always doing something that's illegal. You know, the same thing with the CIA. When you're operating in a foreign nation, unless it's a nation that invited you in, whatever you're doing is inherently illegal. More often than not, there's a very good chance that you'll be taking someone's life, and it's not always necessarily in a firefight, right? There's a bunch of bad things that can happen, especially if you're the type of guy whose job is to go places that we won't admit you go and to do things that we won't admit that you do.
Right.
So it kind of creates this gray area where there's things that are illegal, that if you get caught, you will be held accountable, that your nation tells you to do. And then there are things that are illegal, that if you get caught, you'll be held accountable, that your nation doesn't tell you to do, but there's kind of an inferred acceptance. And then a little bit further down the line, there are things that are illegal, and if you get caught doing, you'll be held accountable, that the nation isn't telling you to do, that there is no inferred acceptance. But it all kind of gets grayer and grayer. We're not just talking about someone taking a life. We're talking about someone who, through the course of their professional responsibilities, may well need to take a life, taking the wrong one. That's a very different distinction than someone like you or me. Me as a journalist, you as a radio host, killing a guy is very different than a Navy SEAL in country killing a guy.
Right,
they're killing guys that they're not supposed to.
One is murder, right? And the other one, well, the other one, as you said, is the execution of our foreign policy. But
and so it becomes easier to convince yourself to make those little allowances. It becomes easier to convince yourself to do things that you would otherwise find morally or ethically revolting.
Let me ask about this. I got an email, and I was talking earlier. Those SEALs did not get sent home from Iraq. And again, this is all done in public, and the Special Operations Community doesn't do this very often. Right, so somebody's message sending to somebody. They did not get.
Think about it. Think about what's going on in SOCOM. Right
yes,
now.
They did not send them home for drinking. They sent them home because SEALs have been drinking inside those firm bases forever. Right, and everybody knows it.
Everybody knows it.
Right, so and they have their parties.
Have you ever met a Navy SEAL? You know that they're drinking there.
Right, and so again, it's just a fact. So there was allegedly there was a rape. And when questioned,
and another guy stealing naked pictures again. Of,
different SEAL team, but in this case, a rape, and every one of them refused to speak to the people investigating. That's why they got sent home. They didn't get sent home because they were drinking. So that's
I do want to point out. We need some level of this in our SEAL community, in our Green Beret community. Maybe not necessarily so much in the Ranger community because it's a broader base and it's a more infantry type environment. But in the Special Operations community at large, we do need a certain level of I'm going to back this guy over the command, right? Because there are certainly circumstances where the command element isn't the good guy and the warfighter on the ground is, or there are certainly circumstances where you are on your own. And it's just you guys without a command element. So you need to be able to count on your brother to have your back. But what they seem to have lost sight of, in my opinion, is that Marine Corps, you know, I'm sure that you can speak to this too. How often did you hate going to the PX on a Saturday and having to correct somebody?
Oh, my God.
It would ruin my day if I had to go over and be like, what the hell is the matter with you?
People stop going. And first of all, your wife says, I'm going to go to the PX, but I don't want you to go with me.
Yes,
because it just ruins it.
And then
your attitude is, I don't want to go there because
I don't want to do it either.
I'm tired of correcting officers and staff NCOs, let alone the younger Marines.
You know, so when you go to the PX, it's like it'll mess with your morning, right? To have to go be that guy. But ultimately, being that guy is why the Marine Corps is what it is.
Right? No doubt.
The fact that we all are willing to shoulder the weight of being that guy, maybe not every time. Maybe sometimes you go, I'm not going to go in. I'll just stay in the car. You can go ahead. But those times that you do go in, we all share the weight of being that guy and making sure that we're not fucked up. You know? If I see your uniform is jacked up, I don't go, oh, man, that guy's uniform is jacked up, and keep walking on my way. Your uniform just became my responsibility. I'm going to go over and yank that thing off, and I'm going to tell you your ribbon rack's on upside down. Because when I see you jacked up as another Marine, you just became my problem, right? That's one thing that we're not seeing in the Special Operations community, but I think it started because they were like that. They were saying, you're my problem. This isn't going to go higher up in the command.
Right.
But eventually that morphed into, we're just going to have each other's back. But they're not managing internally either, clearly.
This is
not a new development.
Right.
This is what I mean about Jack Murphy has been torn apart by the Special Operations community as a former Ranger and a former Green Beret for being the guy that keeps being like, hey, guys, we have absolutely no viz on what it is that they're doing in these SEAL teams. Hey, guys, these Green Berets, you know, this Green Beret was murdered by a Navy SEAL. Hey, guys, we should be looking at this stuff. And he has been torn apart by the Green Beret community, especially,
really?
You know, who see him as a turncoat because he's shining a flashlight into these corners where they're hiding, you know, the things that they do that they'd rather people not found out about.
Only, honestly, only because some of it are war crime. I mean, we don't kill innocent.
That's what pissed me
people.
Off so much about the Gallagher thing, man.
Right.
The American public chose teams in the Gallagher trial, which is even the president chose teams in the Gallagher trial. We're not talking about a trial of one Navy SEAL. I know that's what we want it to be. Look at how good his jaw is. Look at how pretty his wife is. He's the best American ever because he kills bad guys with that chin, right? The fact of the matter is that whether or not America is committing war crimes is a really, really big deal. We use the leverage of us not being a nation that commits war crimes to force other nations, or at least try to force other nations, not to commit them themselves. If we become a nation that embraces and accepts our soldiers, our Marines, our sailors committing war crimes, just because the guy was pretty bad, you know, or just because, look at how downright American he is. Now, I'm not saying that Gallagher was guilty of the specific crime. He was acquitted, and therefore, formally, he is innocent. But he certainly, and other Navy SEALs, certainly were behaving in a way that I don't think is in keeping with how America likes to do business.
Well,
I know war
look.
Is messy
right,
and ugly,
right.
But we need to play by the rules. Otherwise, when we tell Russia to play by the rules, who the hell are we? You know?
No. And again, look, the line I would tell you that most people that have gone to the places that we fight will tell you the line between killing in combat and murder is not a thin line.
No, it's not.
It is pretty wide, and everybody
is literally the exact same physical act. The difference is perception.
Oh my God! It is, and then when you come home and you know people that have crossed that line, and you hear them being, you know, held up in the media as this guy's an American hero, and the Marine Corps railroaded him. You're like, are you shitting me? That guy straight up murdered those people. And
this is the problem that I have, is that we as an American public are really big into judging people on, like, the single or the handful of most prominent factors that we want to characterize everybody as a two-dimensional thing, right? So you could be really, really popular right now, but then we find out that you tweeted something about gays in 2002, and now you're a bad guy, right? You could be Gallagher, and all we want you to be is a Navy SEAL and a hero. You're not allowed to be more complex than that, right? You're not allowed to potentially have made some bad decisions or genuinely have done some bad things because we aren't able to look past Navy SEAL and hero.
Right.
'Cause that's the way we decided to categorize him in the first place, right? Now, I'm not saying that Eddie Gallagher should be in prison because, again, he was acquitted. But what I am saying is that we shouldn't be going, oh, well, wash our hands of that, that's that, everything's good now, he was acquitted. No, there's clearly some systemic issues in our special operations community, and I think that's why you're seeing guys getting thrown out of Iraq right now and stuff. SOCOM is trying to nip every potential thing in the bud now so that it doesn't turn into another one of these situations. Because this is think about what it was like in the Marine Corps, you know, when we saw one Marine throwing puppies off a cliff in videos on YouTube. The whole Marine Corps was a stir. You know, when those MARSOC guys, got in a bunch of trouble for pissing on the bodies of some snipers that killed their friends. The whole Marine Corps was in a huge uproar and stir. SOCOM's a much smaller community. It's a much more tight-knit community. I think that what we're seeing is a knee-jerk reaction, but it's the same knee-jerk reaction we'd see in any branch of any force
when you have this much
bad press this
right,
quickly.
Right. I mean, look, at some point it's not. They're not isolated events anymore. At some point,
exactly.
you have a trend. And again, the other two stories last week, I mean, the one that broke late in the week was the sexting, you know, a member of SEAL Team 6 allegedly, right, posing as somebody else to get nude photographs. And one of them happened to be somebody else on active duty. And now that thing is blown up. And then the one earlier in the week and that we, you know, hello, is the urinalysis thing in SEAL Team 10 on the East Coast, which is, you know, the guys talk about doing cocaine and they didn't have a urinalysis program. They, you know, they had clean urine bottles and dirty urine bottles and shit like that.
You know, and I talked to a buddy of mine who's former Delta about this, and he was like, I tell you what we ought to be looking into is where are they getting the clean pee? You know, because that means that there's a lot more people involved than the SEALs, right? But I think that we're also seeing a very intentional media strategy here and play from the Navy. It's a smart move. The White House does the same thing pretty regularly. Friday afternoons, the White House will dump a bunch of stories on the press all at once. The reason being that most people in the press don't work weekends, right? There's a separate staff that tends to work on the weekends so that you can get a few days off. So you get all these stories dumped on you on Friday. The first thing that you're going to do is you're going to sift through and look for, like, the one you're going to worry about, right? So if there's six or seven really big stories in there, it doesn't matter. You're going to choose the one. The second thing that you're going to do is you're going to pass all the rest of the stuff off to the weekend editors and stuff like that, and they're going to inundate, you know, the media with all these stories, because for them, this is a great get. They got to come up with stuff to plug in either way. CNN is not going to go, oh, there was no news today. There's got to be news every day. So on those Saturdays and Sundays, you're going to get inundated with these big stories. And what ends up happening is you have 10 big stories running simultaneously that all have the same somewhat fundamental elements, like they're all from the White House, they all pertain to Navy SEALs or what have you. It makes it very easy to blur the edges between them. In some people's minds, they all become that one story. It makes it really easy to miss details or even whole stories because you get all of it at once, and then a week from now we're going to forget because there's got to be a new thing for us to be upset about. It's an intentional tactic. It's a very effective one. They use it in PR, too. When companies are running into some bad press, they'll release four or five of those bad press stories simultaneously. So that way we'll talk about nothing but that for 2 days, and then we'll forget all about it and move on. Whereas, you know, those Navy SEALs that were caught drinking, they got caught drinking July 4th. You know, we're talking about a month ago almost. Right. You know, this guy that's been sexting, I promise you, that wasn't revealed yesterday to Navy investigators. This stuff has all been stuff that they've had their eyes on for weeks already. But what they're doing is they're dumping it in our laps all at once so that we'll talk about it now and we'll forget about it next week. And it's a pretty effective strategy.
You know, we'll see. I don't know that I agree with that. Here's what I think. I think now you have people that smell blood in the water relative to the SEALs. And they're saying, oh, really? If they think that's bad, and you're getting emails to reporters about telling them to file a Freedom of Information Act relative to with this command about this issue.
It's 100% true. Right now, this is... I think this stuff is
coming to light.
I can tell you from an editorial standpoint that there is a notable difference in how much traffic, how many clicks and views I will get on a story if I include Navy SEALs in the headline. That's always true, but it's much more true today, right now. We've had meetings before where we've even talked about, listen, guys, we gotta cover more Navy SEAL news. It's what people want from us right now, so we gotta cover more Navy SEAL news, you know.
No.
And it's genuinely true, but right now it's more true than ever. You know, the reason why we always get these stories that are beating up on Donald Trump are because everybody who hates Donald Trump will click on it, and everyone who loves Donald Trump will share it to show people how dumb it is. And we're getting the same thing with Navy SEALs. People who are, you know, red-blooded Americans, I'll support these boys no matter what they do, are sharing these stories to show the hatchet job that the SEAL community is getting. And then the guys that are saying, hey, it's about time we finally held them accountable, they're sharing the stories too, just for different reasons. So, I mean, when you think back to, I mean, Chris Osmond and all those guys getting caught in Haiti, you know, a couple of months back, you know, the former SEALs and a couple other dudes trying to help steal a ton of money from the Haitian National Bank for the president of Haiti. You know, the SEAL community has had a real rough couple of years. But it's
they
weren't,
let me tell you, though, they've earned every bit of it. Nobody's made
every bit of it.
Nobody's made up these stories.
Giving a shit about it this week.
Right. Well,
you know?
No, it's not.
We'll see.
Right.
We'll see what change that manifests.
All right.
You know, the Navy killed a whole bunch of sailors last year by crashing boats into stuff, and this year we don't really give a shit about that.
No, I think we do. To me,
no,
again,
you give a shit.
Right, I give a shit. It's all part of the same horizontal theme of discipline.
Search with Fitzgerald on CNN or the Washington Post or Reuters, and you're not going to find a story for some time for a reason. We've moved on to the latest outrage, and this week it's Navy SEALs. I hope, though, that the Navy uses this trending outrage to manifest some actual change because this is the thing. We're talking about a warfighting apparatus that has been in use for 20 years straight, right? It's tough to do that with anything. You can't do it with a helicopter, let alone a Navy SEAL, right? Obviously, we've got to adjust fire. The Navy SEAL community is not a bad guy community, but obviously we've got to adjust fire. So I really hope that's what they do as a result. And I hope it's not just Band-Aid stuff like we've seen so far in the press.
Well, again, what they've said is we don't have a systemic problem. It's just, look, when you have this many data points, right, of this magnitude.
And you can't say it's not a systemic problem.
Yeah, but you'll read that all the fucking
over and
time.
Over. Well, because if a systemic problem is a failure of the utmost leadership, top-tier leadership.
You're right.
So top-tier leaders are never going to attribute it to that.
At some point, somebody's got to hold somebody accountable and say, you need to go bye-bye.
And you're going to go bye-bye.
Because
the precedent that the Navy set with these ship collisions last year is not a strong one, in my opinion.
No, it was a weak one. All right, tell everybody what you're writing on. You've been writing about you've had some stuff in Popular Mechanics. Tell everybody what you're doing.
I'm going hard in the paint with Pop Mech as of late. I had a couple of pieces with Popular Mechanics go up last week for the 50th anniversary of Apollo. One was the Saturn V, a dive into how it came to be. The other one was all about how difficult it was to get back from the moon. You know, we talk a lot about what an incredible engineering feat it was to get them there. But once they got there, we weren't entirely sure they were going to come back. You know, President Nixon had a speech prepared and on hand to read to the public when they realized that they were just going to stay there to die. It was a really uncertain thing. The space program of the Apollo 11 era is nothing like the space program of today. We're talking about guys who couldn't get life insurance. You know, the government wouldn't give them an SGLI because what they were doing had such a low survivability rate. And it's incredible. The story's fantastic.
What do you mean they wouldn't give them SGLI?
These guys, I swear to God, the Gemini program were famous for this. They would sign 8x10 photographs of themselves and give them to their wives to sell if they died. Because these guys couldn't get life insurance.
At that point, doesn't the federal government step in and say, okay, look.
One would have hoped.
We're asking you to put a seatbelt on and ride a rocket.
The lunar module, you know, people know, everybody knows that the lunar module in some places was only as thick as a few pieces of tinfoil, right?
Right.
Most people don't know. It didn't even have chairs. There were no chairs in it. To seatbelt in, you would strap yourself to the floor. They slept in hammocks. They spent most of their time standing, and there was barely enough room for them both to lay on the floor next to each other. You know, these guys spent weeks, literally. It was like 3 days out, a couple of days there, 3 days back. So more than a week. In less space than you'll find in a sedan, in a Dodge Charger nowadays. And there was no guarantee that these guys were going to survive this. Again, you know, we're talking about they made it 238,000 miles to the moon, landed there, launched another rocket from the surface of the moon, docked in orbit, and flew all the way back with less computing power than my lawnmower has. These guys, their lives were in danger very literally at every moment of the Apollo 11 mission, and I think it's absolutely incredible. So I really encourage you to swing by Popular Mechanics. My story about the return trip is still pretty high up in their top stories for the week. I really recommend reading it, not because I do feel as though I did an all right job with the piece, but how I did about the piece doesn't matter. The story is just incredible, and I'm working on another couple of things for Popular Mechanics right now. I don't want to tell you guys too much about it, but I'm really excited because one of the things I'm working on will be the first thing I wrote for them that will appear in the magazine as opposed to on their website. I'm really pumped about that. And as always, you can find me on theloadoutroom.com. I've got a new series that debuted last week that shows up every morning at 08 called How to Survive Anything, where every day it's just a short video explaining a real short survival tip. Today, the tip is all about the universal edibility test and how to determine what plants are safe to eat in the wild. So check out loadoutroom.com and swing by my Facebook, facebook.com/AlexHollingsWriter, or my Twitter, twitter.com@AlexHollings52. You can find me everywhere. Just go to alexhollings.com and you can find all that stuff listed right there.
In 2 weeks when you come back, I want to start with assuming that Area 51 doesn't get assaulted. I want to start with how to survive anything.
Oh, I'd love to.
And some of the things that you're going through, because I was surprised at the number of people that are interested in whether it be prepping for Armageddon or prepping for disasters. But you know,
it's been a really good thing for me too, because some of this stuff I felt like I knew until I started researching to make the videos and realized I didn't actually know that well. Like, boiling water for 60 seconds to make it potable, I knew, but I didn't know that above 6,000 meters, you have to, or above 6,000? 2,000 meters. Above 2,000 meters, sorry. You've got to boil it for 3 minutes as opposed to one to make it potable. I knew you needed to boil it longer at high altitude. I never knew, you know, where the line was. Or some other things, like it's not all wilderness survival. I did one yesterday about crowd crushes, like if you're in a nightclub and there's an active shooter, you know, how to get yourself out of a crowd crush where you're being squished by a mob. A lot of stuff that, you know, I live out here in the woods, I don't think about all too often, but I think is really important to know.
Wait a minute, you don't live in the woods anymore. You're the suburban guy.
I know, I live in suburbia, but I tell you what, every day, if I'm not writing, my week is split up into days where I have to spend either writing and editing, or days that I spend taking pictures and filming. So I spend at least a good 2.5-3 days a week still as deep into the woods as I can get, and then I just come back out here to do the typing.
Right, and to see your kid. All right.
Yeah, I guess.
All right, bud. Thank you very much for the visit. Have a good week.
Hey, thanks for having me, man.
There you have it. Alex Hollings here on a Monday edition of All Marine Radio. That'll do it. All right, if you're just tuning in, I've got a bit of an op-ed kind of in my head that we talk about in the first hour. And three more Marines were arrested over the weekend. The total is 21 now. And, you know, some of the stuff that, you know, that I've learned is disturbing. And, again, none of those Marines joined the Marine Corps to become a smuggler. So, and Alex kind of asked a good question. As the Marine Corps looks at this and finds out what happened and why, is this Marines that were bad Marines? Or is this a larger issue inside the Marine Corps where you have things like no company formation, so you don't see the company gunny looking at people every day and making sure that staff NCOs and NCOs below him or her are doing their job? And I'll tell you what, and if that's gone from the Marine Corps, that is not a good thing. Because novices, everybody needs to be supervised. And in particular, novices do. And I don't give a fuck what senior Lance Corporals have to say about that. All right. Have a great day. On a Monday, All Marine Radio. Over and out.